Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I am John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Tuesday, April 11, 2017. The ICRC is helping civilians wounded in yesterday's attack on Wau town by men in military uniform.
There are so many wounded people, but as you can imagine, movement is quite difficult for the people because they fear. That means that even those who might need to get to hospital might not be able to move and get there.
And the Kiir administration rejects foreigners to be part of a UN protection force, saying they must be from the region.
These forces who are coming are Nepalese. We asked them and as to why are you bringing these people. They said we are bringing these people because they are technocrats. They are engineers and medical doctors. And we said these forces here in the region, is it true that they have no engineering sections?
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Thousands of South Sudanese continue to pour into UN protection of civilian sites and church compounds after yesterday's deadly attack on Wau town. Residents say men in uniform killed dozens of unarmed civilians. Michael Atit reports for VOA from Juba.
Noura Justo Juma, a DBT community leader at the UN-run camp, says the IDPs fled their homes in Nazareth, Kosti, Gonia, following yesterday's attack on civilians. She says most of the displaced are arriving at the camp with no belongings because the gunmen also looted their homes.
Any person, any family coming in, they have to receive you in the gate, right, register your name and your family member, then you enter. There is a specific place for them, like the distribution site. This is where now they are receiving newcomers to that site. But no any kind of services is started up to now.
The POC site in Wau has been hosting about 27,000 IDPs who fled their homes since violence broke out in Wau in the middle of last year. But now, Juma says, there are at least 30,000 IDPs at the camp. Juma says community leaders at the camp are working closely with the International Organization for Migration to provide food, shelter, and medicine to the thousands of newly arrived IDPs. Regina Gabriel Gok, who fled the violence from Nazareth neighborhood, says most of her neighbors were killed. Speaking in Arabic by phone from Wau, Gok says she fled to the UN camp with 8 family members, but none of them had time to grab anything from the house. Gok says the situation in the town is calm today, but people are still heading to the POC site and church compounds because they are afraid. She says no one wants to stay behind after seeing their family members being killed. Gok says once security improves, they will go back home. Residents say armed men in military uniform conducted house-to-house search yesterday and killed dozens of unarmed Wau civilians. In a statement issued yesterday, the United Nations mission in South Sudan said at least 16 people were killed. A Wau state government official contradicted the figure, saying only 6 people were killed and 4 others wounded. The International Committee of the Red Cross says its team of 4 medical workers are in Wau to help treat the wounded at Wau Teaching Hospital. Robin Waudo, ICRC Communication Coordinator, confirms at least 28 people were admitted at the hospital in Wau yesterday. He says the ICRC team is conducting emergency surgery on patients in critical condition.
There are so many wounded people, but as you can imagine, movement is quite difficult for the people because they fear. That means that even those who might need to get to hospital might not be able to move and get there.
Waudu says the ICRC delivered 700 life-saving medical kits to the hospital. That includes anesthesia drugs, antibiotics, and sutures. He says such kits can be used to treat 50 wounded people. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Juba.
The South Sudan government says it opposes troops from countries outside the East Africa region to be part of the UN-backed Regional Protection Force, scheduled to be deployed in South Sudan in a week's time. A top UN United Nations official said the force will include troops from Bangladesh and Nepal. Waki Simon Wudu has more for VOA from Juba.
South Sudan Information Minister Michael Makuei told the reporters following a cabinet meeting chaired by President Salva Kiir on Friday that the government does not accept the inclusion of troops from outside the region in the Regional Protection Force.
These forces who are coming are Nepalese and Bangladesh. These forces are not part of the region. This is one. We asked them and as to why are you bringing these people. They said we are bringing these people because they are technocrats. They are engineers and medical doctors. And we said these forces here in the region, is it true that they have no engineering sections? And there are no medical corps.
Makuei says the Kiir administration only wants countries in the regional bloc IGAD should contribute troops to the Regional Protection Force. He says any attempt to include troops from outside countries in the Regional Protection Force will be a violation of the agreement Juba reached with the UN last year.
If they bring in forces from outside the region, then they are definitely in violation of the agreement. And if they want to bring the forces from outside the region, then they must change the name of the force. There is no way you bring in people from outside the region and you call them Regional Protection Force.
James Okuk, a political science lecturer at the University of Juba, says it shouldn't really matter whether or not troops from countries inside or outside the IGAD region are part of the protection force.
The most important thing with the RPF is the mandate, so, and the command. So already we know that the command will be from Africa and they are under the UNMISS. And already we know the command of the peacekeeping operation within UNMISS is also from Africa, from Rwanda. So in both cases, already you have the region commanding the UNMISS forces and you would have the region commanding the particular RPF within the UNMISS forces. So I don't see any cause of worry. On this,
the UN Security Council resolution authorized deployment of the Regional Protection Force in South Sudan under the Chapter 7 Charter, which stipulates that the UN Security Council shall determine the existence of any threat to peace or act of aggression and shall make recommendations or decide what measures are to be taken. Last month, Hafalat Sous, the former UN Undersecretary for Peacekeeping Operations, told the reporters on his final visit to South Sudan before stepping down that the protection force would be arriving in the country in a few weeks and that the force would include troops from Rwanda, Ethiopia, Nepal and Bangladesh.
We are working actively on it. We did lose time because there were a number of slownesses in getting clearances, authorizations here, but we are sparing no effort to speed up, and I think I can say that in the next few weeks you will see the first vanguard of the Regional Protection Force being deployed actually here in Juba.
Makuei confirms some of the Protection Force commanders have already arrived in the country. The deployment of the Protection Force to South Sudan was initiated and agreed last year by the UN Security Council and backed by the IGAD. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
Some community leaders in Jubek State say they face challenges in trying to promote peace and end violence in their communities. They are accusing government officials of failing to support traditional authority. A community leader from Mangala attending a workshop in Juba says the conflict has worsened intercommunal relationship, as we hear from Tito Justin in Juba.
Several community leaders attending the two-day workshop say cases of ethnically motivated gender-based violence and sexual assault are on the increase in many of their communities. Traditional chiefs say they are capable of ending such violence, but charge the national government has stripped them of their power to do so. Speaking Arabic, Unduruba County Chief Daniel Abjon says he knows how to put an end to violence in his community, but he cannot do that if the ongoing conflict continues.
It is true, the situation of Unduruba is not normal. The situation is worse. So if you go there, you will not get any person staying in their usual homes. Everyone is hiding in the bush. Houses were burned and everything. There is nothing going fine in this nation.
Civilians in Undruba, which is located about 50 miles from Juba, say they watched armed men in military uniforms repeatedly attack the civilians since last year. As a result, Abjun says most civilians fled their homes months ago.
If the government is able to end the violence and accept peace with people, then this country will be fine. But if it's like the way people are now, one will not say the situation will be normal. Because people have fear. Because now when they get you, you are killed. Women are raped.
Jubek State Mangala County Chief Michael Ladu says he has tried in vain to explain many times to residents of his community that they must all work together to end violence in the area.
I said if there is a measure, it kalama sabab del.
When we speak to youths and people who cause conflict, they don't respect us because we don't have power. Power is very important for the chiefs. We don't have soldiers, but when we arrest people and take them to the government does not care about it.
Speaking Arabic, John Andrea Tombe, Jubek State's leader county chief, wants government officials to deploy police officers to rural communities that will back the chief's efforts to end violence in their communities.
If this fails completely, better allow us to recruit local militias in the village so that chiefs have power. If you see in the villages, the chiefs have ways to end violence, but they don't have the power, making them unable to do their work. This is what is hurting us.
Manyi Ako Irene is a lobbyist who works for the Catholic Organization for Relief and Development Aid, or CODAID. She says traditional leaders often fail to end violence in their communities because they no longer know their role in society. Irene says traditional leaders should have support from the government and NGOs to develop their capacity so they can solve community issues.
When the traditional leaders understand what we're doing and then they do it, and then they are able now to engage with the government and say, okay, at the levels of the community, this is what happened in our communities. We face these things firsthand. We suffer from these things, but we don't want to suffer from these things any longer. Then they can now engage with policymakers or other important state officials and even actors from the private sectors and say, no, this is what we want and this is how we want it.
About 20 traditional leaders attended the workshop, which is being funded by CODAID. The chiefs are expected to use the skills they learn at the two-day workshop to train more local leaders on how to end violence in their communities and improve justice for victims of criminal activity on the local level. For VOA News, I am Tito Justin in Juba.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, we take a look at environment and sickness. That story is coming up next.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what or who inspires you?
My inspiration is this great African-American who is called Martin Luther. This guy has inspired me so very much. You know, when I was in my secondary level, I happened to listen to his speeches.
My auntie, she really inspires me with the way she handles things, manage her home, her business. It really helps me and boosts my energy to go on and move on in my career and my family as well.
What inspires me is positivity or optimism. I'm a very positive person. I believe anything you put yourself to do can be done with the right attitude.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. It's time for our Tuesday health segment, and today we are talking about the effects of being sick. It turns out that sick people can be bad for the environment. A new study conducted at Lake Victoria in Kenya says human illness can cause people to be less concerned about the nature when trying to make a living. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
This is the story of a fish and a virus, and how they changed life and the environment in and around Lake Victoria. In the 1960s, British colonists dramatically changed Lake Victoria when they introduced the Nile perch. The predatory fish quickly dominated the lake. In fact, hundreds of native species of fish went extinct. But the Nile perch is good eating and a good living. Commercial fishing soared in Kenya, Uganda, and Tanzania during the 1980s and 90s, and caused the perch population to decline. Regulations were put in place to conserve it. Around the same time, HIV, the virus that causes AIDS, began infecting fishing communities. As the people got sicker, environmental exploitation of Lake Victoria got worse. A polluted environment can cause health problems in people, and unhealthy people can cause health problems for the environment. That's the key finding of a study published in the journal Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. It tracked the health of more than 300 households in fishing communities on Continental Island in Lake Victoria. Catherine Fiorella is the lead author and a fellow at the Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future at Cornell University.
Lake Victoria has a really long and fascinating history of how environmental changes have related to what's going on with people who live nearby. And so this is a system that sort of drew our attention for that reason.
She says migration helps spread HIV, setting the stage for environmental harm.
The changes that happened as Lake Victoria became a really profitable fishery also meant that people were moving a lot in that area right around the same time that HIV was spreading relatively unchecked around East Africa. And so today there's a tremendously high prevalence of HIV around Lake Victoria. And in the communities that we studied, the prevalence of HIV is over 27% among adults.
Fiorella says studies suggest that people who are sick will spend less time working. Being sick certainly can affect one's ability to work.
That's been true in some agricultural systems. We've seen that in HIV-affected communities who are engaged in agriculture. What we found among people who think of themselves as a fisher, they may still be spending a really considerable amount of time in their livelihood. They might be also switching what they do. People were actually changing the ways that they were fishing.
But changing the way they fished was not good for Lake Victoria. Some methods were outright illegal or strictly regulated because they can damage fish habitats or breeding grounds or catch fish that are too young or too small.
So we saw that people were switching between different types of methods when they were responding to being sicker or feeling better. And what they were doing largely was avoiding some of the methods that involve going really deep into the lake and are part of some more sustainable fisheries when they were feeling sicker and being more likely to engage in some of the methods that are based on or near the shore when they were sicker. And those are also the methods that are illegal and unsustainable in the system.
Fiorella and her colleagues questioned the fishers four times over the course of a year.
We were able to see that health by itself is having an impact on whether or not they're making these switches between different methods.
Being sick can change the fisher's outlook on life, focusing more on immediate needs. The study highlights the importance of readily available health care and how that relates to sustainable livelihoods and the management of natural resources. So, the story of a fish and a virus helps scientists better understand the effect of human illness on the environment. The end is yet to be written, as further study is planned. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Still on health matters, researchers say there's a link between the climate phenomenon El Niño and the number of cases of cholera in East Africa. As VOA's Jessica Berman reports, predicting when there is going to be an El Niño event could be key to public health preparedness.
El Niño is a global climate phenomenon that occurs at irregular times, approximately every 2 to 7 years. During an El Niño, surface ocean temperatures in the eastern Pacific off the coast of South America become warmer than usual. That warming trend begins around Christmas time. The following year, in the fall, sea surface temperatures also warm, if somewhat less, in the western Pacific, leading to extreme weather events like flooding and droughts, conditions that are ripe for cholera outbreaks. Approximately 177 million people reside in areas where the incidence of cholera increases during El Niño, but there's been scant evidence of El Niño's health impact in Africa. In a study published in Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, epidemiologist Sean Moore led a team that found the incidence of cholera increased in countries in East Africa.
Because they either lead to surface flooding that can wash contamination into the drinking water, in areas where there's open defecation. It also can lead to overflowing of sewer systems in urban areas, which again can lead to contamination of drinking water.
There are approximately 150,000 cases of cholera per year, mostly in sub-Saharan Africa, according to Moore, an epidemiologist at Johns Hopkins School of Public Health in Baltimore. But during El Niños, researchers found the incidence swelled by more than 50,000 cholera cases in eastern Africa. Patterns of shift in the number of cholera cases were measured during El Niños between the years 2000 and 2014. There was also 30,000 fewer cases reported in southern Africa during El Niño years compared to non-El Niño years. Without treatment, mortality rates from cholera can climb as high as 50%, to the extent that the climate phenomenon can be predicted 6 to 12 months ahead of time. Moore says public health officials can prepare for outbreaks.
Sort of an advance warning could it, even if it doesn't prevent an outbreak, could at least prevent the deaths that tend to occur during the early part of an outbreak.
With oral rehydration therapy, according to Moore, the risk of death from cholera drops to 1%. He says there are now cheap cholera vaccines that could be used to prevent the disease before El Niño happens. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
International aid agencies say there is a growing risk of mass deaths from starvation in the Horn of Africa, Yemen, Nigeria, and South Sudan. Lisa Schlein is in Geneva and reports that a lack of money is further aggravating the humanitarian crisis.
Aid agencies are haunted by the specter of the 2011 famine in the Horn of Africa, which killed more than 260,000 people, half of them children under age 5. They do not want a repeat of that tragedy, but say they fear the severity of the current humanitarian crisis gripping Yemen, the Horn of Africa, and neighboring countries could result in an even worse outcome. The UN Refugee Agency reports hunger and conflict are forcing increasing numbers of people to flee within their countries and across borders in search of food and refuge. UNHCR spokesman Adrian Edwards says refugee numbers are escalating.
Consecutive harvests have failed. Conflict in South Sudan, coupled with drought, is leading to famine and outflows of refugees. Insecurity in Somalia is leading to rising internal displacement, and rates of malnutrition are high, especially among children and lactating mothers.
Edwards says in the Dolo-Ado area of southeast Ethiopia, acute malnutrition rates among very young, newly arriving Somali refugee children are running between 50 and nearly 80%. Aid agencies have been scaling up their humanitarian operations in northeastern Nigeria, South Sudan, Somalia, and Yemen, where more than 20 million people are experiencing famine or are on the brink of famine. But Edwards tells VOA the efforts may be doomed to failure. He warns problems will reach catastrophic levels unless funds are received.
What we're looking at is the needs for funding from across donors and across the international community. This really is an absolutely critical situation that is rapidly unfolding across a large swathe of Africa from west to east. It does need most urgent addressing now from a really concerted international action.
Earlier this year, the United Nations launched an appeal for $4.4 billion to provide life-saving assistance in the four famine-affected countries. As of now, only 21% of that amount has been received, far from enough to avert a humanitarian catastrophe. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In response to the growing number of displaced South Sudanese in the past few months, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees say it is adjusting its estimate for refugee pouring into neighboring countries, and the UNHCR says it too has many problems. Ayen Bior has more on that from Washington.
UNHCR spokesman Adrian Edwards told reporters at a press briefing today they are now anticipating that tens of thousands of additional South Sudanese refugees will cross the border into neighboring countries this year.
In Sudan, for example, where our initial estimate was for 60,000 arrivals from South Sudan this year, we are in the process of revising the expected total upwards to about 180,000. Similarly, in Uganda, we're revising planning from 300,000 displaced to 400,000.
And all this comes at a time when funding shortfalls have made it much harder for UN agencies to assist millions of refugees. For example, Edward says the World Food Program has had to slash its food rations by at least 20% in Ethiopia, Tanzania, and Rwanda.
And in Uganda by up to 75%. Many refugees are without full access to livelihoods and agriculture or food production possibilities, so their abilities to take matters into their own hands and help themselves is very limited.
Edward says the humanitarian community is trying to circumvent hundreds of thousands of deaths in the region. He says the 2011 drought killed more than 260,000 people, half of them under the age of five. He says with the extreme funding shortage, organizations like the World Food Program are operating with no money to buy food, even as they try to scale up efforts to meet the growing needs.
What we want at all costs is to avoid a repeat of that kind of cataclysmic loss of life. It is, you know, to come back to my point, what has to happen now is that funding has to come in so that we can, the humanitarian effort can try its best to do something about this situation, but already it is very late.
While large pockets of insecurity in South Sudan has forced thousands to flee, harvests have also failed year after year, according to UNHCR, which means people are forced to rely on the World Food Program for assistance. Ayen Bior, VOA News, Washington.
That's our show for this Tuesday. We now leave you with a song, Sokpa, by Gonda Ogolo, who sings in his native Balanda language.
Baba Ungolo, Kaizenove, Neruguda, Tasoba, Rugude, Bindo Muso, Kubu, Zoiso, Ama binzo ba aleti kawi ama bote
sonwa bongo ta kubandongo di belezi kanakoba dawa ya biti dado meketo ngo belezo
da beleno bito
si kanakome di di sekba da si sona langana da ta si binzo mina yawe
da ti magbinzo nondini. The two can of the son of that Imano
Merego Fubamaika no Katanti Mano Yaway Zanande
Merego
Zanande Merego Fubandong Lang no Katanti Mano Yaway
Dadokita Zonundi
Zanande
Adoba Danzoma Fogi
So Abongotan Abandong.
The Dinganti,
Kurunanti, Mota Dumuti Velezoki, the Ufoki Sona, Metis the Sona Tinta Zegba, Sisona Langana, Data Sikinzo Mina Yawe,
the Tikumata Yenunzi,
Tapo
Sodaye,
Amago Mata Yeba.
We have been listening to Gunda Ogolo with the song Sopa. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for tuning in. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Mere